Hello and welcome to SNG Podcast. I'm Nitin Gokhale. Recently, I had an occasion to have a discussion with former Foreign Secretary Vijay Gokhale, not only on his latest book, which deals with the crisis in the Taiwan Strait in the 1950s, and how major players from the United States and Great Britain to India and China dealt with the crisis and the interplay between them in the international politics took place at that time. However, we also discussed what is the way forward as far as Taiwan-China relations are concerned currently in the aftermath of the elections that have taken place, and in which William Lai, who is opposed to China's hegemony over Taiwan, will play out in the current context, and whether China will dare to push the envelope further than it has done or not. Take a listen. So let me turn to the book's basic premise. And the title is quite long, Crosswinds, and then you have Nehru, Chou En Lai, Anglo-American competition over China. We'll come to the current situation, but why this book?
Yeah, that's a good question, Nitin. See, when I started, I had two questions in my mind. Why did India recognize the People's Republic of China in 1949? What were the factors behind it? What were the reasons for recognizing China so early? And the second question I had in my mind is, why did India's relations with the United States not take off in the early 1950s, although the United States had supported us in our freedom struggle, even telling the British during the Second World War to give India independence? Yet we did not see the Americans as partners. And that is how I began the research into this book. And when I did research, I came to the conclusion that there was a third party involved, both in our relations with the new Chinese communist government and with the United States, and that was the British Empire. So although the British had exited India in 1947, they continued to exercise an influence over Indian foreign policy making. And as a result, it in a way distorted our relations with both major countries, China and the United States. And that became the basic foundation for this book. And I believe that a lot of the archival material I have unearthed has probably not been written before this, and therefore adds value to our understanding Indian foreign policy making in the first decade after independence.
So you actually gave ammunition to Nehru's, Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru's critics, when they say that he was influenced by the British and continued to be influenced by the British in his foreign policy assertions. But that apart, when you say that the British continued to play a role in the Indian thinking, who were the main people that they would have influenced, or which way did they influence the Indian foreign policy thinking?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I have written this book based on facts, and the facts do establish that our first Prime Minister was at critical moments more willing to take advice or suggestions from the British than from the Americans, for instance. So these are facts that I've put forward. To some extent, that was natural because, after all, the British had ruled India, and therefore the new Indian leadership was most familiar with the British. There was a certain comfort value. But the facts also show how Britain very cleverly manipulated the political leadership of India and, to some extent, even the US leaders in an effort to ensure that their interests prevailed. Mm-hmm. Because one of the key points I make in the book is that both the United States and the British Empire had very different interests in the Pacific and towards China. The US was interested in stopping communism. It had a geostrategic objective. The British objective was to preserve its empire, which basically meant colonies and trading rights. So one wanted confrontation with China. The other was willing to do accommodation with China. And since we were the only other major Asian power, we got pulled in two directions. What appears out of my research is that we did not take some fairly sound American advice. And here I do feel that the tendency to depend on the British led us to ignore or put aside advice which was very sensible from the US side especially on the issue of recognition of the People's Republic of China.
So, when we come to China, the British interests were mainly on trading and trying to get back to their preeminent position before the Japanese had ousted them in China, the nationalist China at that point in time before the communists took over. And the American interests were geostrategic, like you said, that they wanted to be the predominant power in Pacific. But apart from Jawaharlal Nehru, who were the other protagonists in India? Was it Krishna Menon, Panikkar? Who are the guys who actually also contributed to this tilt, if I may say so?
Well, certainly two of his close political associates, Sardar Panikkar in the early part, that is the late 1940s and early 1950s, and of course from 1954 onwards, V.K. Krishna Menon. These were people on whose advice he depended. And they had a significant influence on the final decision. For example, Panikkar's messages from China, where he was India's ambassador to nationalist China, about how, in his view, the United States had got it wrong on China, did influence the way in which the government of India also looked at US advice that was being given on the question of recognition. In the same way, I think the relationship that Prime Minister Nehru and V.K. Krishna Menon had led Nehru to trust Krishna Menon's judgment on the Taiwan Straits crisis over the judgment of professionals in the Ministry of External Affairs or other political leaders. So what I can say is that certainly on policy towards China and the United States, these two political associates of Nehru had a disproportionate influence. And I think some of the mishaps that occurred, policy mishaps that occurred, might also be attributed to them.
So that includes Tibet, India's treatment or India's approach towards Tibet and China at that point in time in that decade, subsequently leading to the 1962 disaster. All that would have played into all this. But my point before coming to the current situation, which also you have brought out in the book, and you talked about how we are probably coming back to the situation in the 50s in the Indo-Pacific now, what used to be called Asia-Pacific. But Nehru's approach towards China and recognizing China, what was the main driver, you think, after going through the archival material?
Yeah, so I think first let me begin by saying Nehru had a strategic vision. If you look at the material I have in the book, as early as 1 year before the establishment of the communist government, he was telling his own officials not to waste time with the expiring government of President Chiang Kai-shek and to start working on how to deal with a new potentially communist regime. So there was a strategic vision. He also on more than one occasion said, if we have to build an Asian order for Asians, we need Asian partners, and China was one of the obvious partners. So there was a strategic vision. But it was not accompanied by sound strategy and tactics. And that was perhaps because we were not clear on what objectives our policy was serving. So in the end, it became more an exercise of optics and an exercise of procedure rather than an achievement of objectives. And as a result, we had no asks from the Chinese side. It was a question of merely serving the interest of recognizing them on the hope that once the new government was established, they would partner with us on the new Asian order. But we never actually asked them whether they would do so. I do mention in the book that for the first 5 years after we recognized the People's Republic of China, there was not even direct contact between any senior Indian political figure and Chinese political figure. That shows that a lot of presumptions were not tested.
Right.
And that was the start of perhaps a foreign policy towards China, which may not have been based on sound understanding of the new leadership and the new government.
Or even the realities.
Or even the realities, yes.
And like you said, that we didn't ask anything from China in return. One of them that you mentioned was the overflight rights that the Americans wanted. And we denied them because we thought, or the Nehru government thought, that the Chinese will get upset.
Yes, in fact, the one other element in this book is it is as much a reflection of how we made policy with the United States. logically, they should have been our partner. They were a democracy that supported us in the independence struggle. They were giving us economic assistance. And yet we saw them simply through the prism of the Cold War. We therefore dismissed even sound American advice. And where the Americans wanted even marginal assistance, such as overflight of their military aircraft, which was transporting French troops from Africa to Indochina, we refused them almost as a means of self-sanctioning, because the Chinese government did not ask us to do so. We did so because we felt we should be sensitive to their concerns. I think, in a sense, the current approach that our government has, which is we need to be mutually sensitive to each other's concerns, ought to have been the mantra at that time. But it was a very unilateral sensitivity to China's concerns. China showed no sensitivity on the Kashmir issue, no sensitivity on any other concern of ours. So it was simply unidirectional.
Yeah, so that I think was a fatal kind of a mistake, policy mistake. But coming to the current situation, let me start first with Taiwan. With the elections over there, and the president, of course, has been elected from the DPP, the ruling DPP. But the parliament seems to be hung. And the Chinese haven't reacted very violently or vehemently at the results. What is your assessment of the current cross-strait relations or the tensions that are there?
I think I would begin with two conclusions. First, that despite China's best efforts to ensure that a more pro-Beijing government or president would be elected, they could not stop the Democratic People's Party from winning an unprecedented third term as president. Although the incumbent has changed, because you can only be president
for two terms.
But the DPP candidate has won for the third time. In other words, despite all the arsenal that Beijing deployed, including military exercises as well as propaganda, they failed to make a difference. That leads me to the second conclusion, which is that there is a growing body of people in China, in Taiwan, who now feel that they have a separate identity, an identity which is not identical to that of the mainland. And this is more and more the sense in the younger generation. So today you have a position where China has no option but to deal with its worst case scenario for the next 4 years, at least in political terms.
Right.
Now, and that is why I guess the Chinese have moderated their reaction as well, because you have no choice. On the other hand, as you correctly observed, the parliament is a hung parliament. And therefore, the noises being made by the president designate also have been relatively moderate.
Right.
He is talking of working with the Chinese, cooperating with them, while of course emphasizing that if anything happens to Taiwan, hard measures will be taken.
Right.
So you're seeing a measure of moderation on both sides. It's anybody's guess whether that will last. And my own guess is that we will probably see a harder line by both sides once the current government becomes comfortable in Taipei.
Oh, yeah. So let's watch how it goes. And some of the Taiwanese officials or think tank officials were here last week. And they had a similar sense that it's going to be a difficult phase because of the peculiar position in the parliament. And of course, Chinese relentless effort to interfere in Taiwan. But we'll see how it goes. Coming to your final chapter in the book again, which talks about the current situation in the Indo-Pacific. You make an assertion, or at least you have a theory, that it is now almost akin to what happened in the 1950s, and the British will be given the job by the Americans to look at the Indian Ocean, let's say, or the Indo-Pacific, because they want to concentrate on the Pacific itself. How do you justify that?
Yeah, so let me begin by saying I'm not saying that the situation in the 1950s has been replicated in the 2020s. First of all, the United States is no longer as dominant as it was. Secondly, China is much stronger and is capable of challenging the United States in its periphery. Thirdly, India is much more influential than it was. Lastly, the British Empire has faded away entirely. So the situation is not identical. But one thing has persisted over these 70 years, and that is the hotspots in the Asia Pacific. Korea, Taiwan and the South China Sea have remained constant.
Right.
And you now have the reversion to a situation where the United States and China see each other as an existential problem, as they did in the 50s.
Sure.
So we are operating in a similar environment,
right,
where the two major powers are on the path of confrontation, and I don't mean conflict,
yes, confrontation. Yes.
And we have to find our position in this developing situation.
Mm.
My contention is that the United States does not have the capability and will not going forward have the capability to be able to police both the Indian and Pacific Oceans. And because its primary focus is the Pacific, since China is its principal adversary, it might tend to outsource or at least delegate some of the responsibility for managing Indian Ocean affairs to its allies. And the establishment of AUKUS is a body which I feel might take on that responsibility, and that might bring the United Kingdom back into the Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a number of others have said that the Britain just does not have the capacity as it did in the 1950s,
sure,
and I have no problem with that argument.
Mm.
But politically speaking, if we allow the British to interpret the Indian Ocean to the Americans, then we are reaching the situation I've mentioned in the book of the 1950s, where it inserted itself into the Indo-US relationship and it colored the view of both sides. So the point I'm making is we must talk directly with the Americans and we must talk directly with the Chinese. We must not let a third party, particularly Great Britain, come into that calculus. And that's the very small point that I make at the end of that book.
It's a fair point, and exactly the point that you've been making about how India should talk politically to China too. But this is an interesting point that if you have to talk about Indo-Pacific, talk to the Americans directly rather than, you know, get into the Quad, maybe. No, I mean, the Quad is of course there, but not allow Great Britain to insert itself, which I think was also a mistake we made in the Indian subcontinent. I mean, vis-a-vis Pakistan, for instance. They continue to have disproportionate influence over the Americans, the British establishment. And I think that is a fair point I think there will be a lot of debate. But it's good to start that debate. And this book, I'm sure, will be read by serious students of international relations and foreign policy. So thank you for writing this.